Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We have done our job, highlighted certain areas that we felt were not, the standards were not reached in those areas. Now it remains for the political players in this country and also the Zimbabwean people at large to go through these things and assess for themselves if what has happened is free and fair to them.
Zimbabwe opposition rejects the outcome of the general election.
So for us, this is a way of healing. This is a way of bringing peace into the heart of Ugandans.
In Uganda, a public lecture about Idi Amin is set to begin on September 1st in the capital, Kampala.
So it's important for us to question what type of human resource do we need to achieve the economically prosperous and socially stable Benin.
And in Benin, an aspiring presidential candidate says building an economy with emphasis on production and processing is a key component to creating jobs for the country's youth. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission has declared President Emmerson Mnangagwa as winner of the presidential contest with 52.6% of the total vote cast. Main challenger Nelson Chamisa, leader of the Opposition Citizens for Coalition or CCC, came in second with 44%. But the CCC rejected the outcome of the election, citing voter irregularities, rigging, intimidation and harassment of members of the opposition during the election process. Both local and international poll observers expressed concern about transparency during the polling. Dr. Neves Mumba is a former Zambian vice president and head of the Southern African Poll Observer Mission, or SADC mission, that monitored the Zimbabwe general election. I reached him and began by asking him to give an assessment of the just concluded Zimbabwe elections.
We are here on a mission, and our mission has been very clear from the beginning. That is to observe the process of this election and look along the way to see if there are any activities that contradict the very position of the Constitution of Zimbabwe, the Electoral Act, and because Zimbabwe is a member of the SADC community, we also weigh the performance of the electoral process against our guidelines and our principles. And after doing all that, we produced the statement that was announced to the nation and to the global community as to our findings. And our findings are very clear. And in there, we felt that our colleagues would have done better to adhere to those, positions that we have asserted.
What were your major concerns or observation during the election process?
Well, I think we talked about the voters' role having been a major secret that we felt should have been shared with the stakeholders, because that's really the election, the printing of the ballot papers, that were not really done in a way that other stakeholders could know what's happening. And we thought those were, real red lights, and we wanted them to consider the fact that we have observed that transparency was not there. We talked about many issues that I do not have to repeat in our statement. I would only encourage our listeners to read our statement. It's very elaborate. It's based on fact. It's a scientific document. And it is also a document that is supported by the Constitution. What the variants from the Constitution, the variants from the Electoral Act, the variants from the guidelines and principles of SADC. So, everything is in there, and we think that, we are not basing our challenge in this election on anything else but what they have prescribed for themselves as the law and the Electoral Act, and basically that's what we have done.
Well, Dr. Mumba, the CCC has rejected the outcome, saying it lacked transparency and there were concerns of voter irregularities and all that. Do you think their criticism of the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission and the outcome of the election are legitimate?
Well, I think that we have done a report, and I think some of their concerns are reflected in our report. And so the way it goes over here is that this is an internal issue. It's a Zimbabwean issue now. We have done our job, highlighted certain areas that we felt were not, the standards were not reached in those areas. Now it remains for the political players in this country and also the Zimbabwean people at large to go through these things and assess for themselves if what has happened is free and fair to them. And I think if there are any grievances, those with grievances can go further and ask the courts to sort of settle those matters. And that's how we have advised them, that use the available channels for you to express your concerns. And this is too early in the day to know what the opposition is going to do, what the Zimbabwean people are going to do. But I think that, ZEC, which is an electoral body, has gone ahead and announced, and that is their mandate to do that. But I'm sure the Zimbabwean people now will have to deal with what has happened and either applaud it or question it.
Well, so what would be your best advice to the people of Zimbabwe moving forward after observing these elections and coming up with suggestions or recommendations that you think could help improve future elections in Zimbabwe?
Yeah, look, we were not the only observers. And I think that whether it was the European Union, whether it was the Africa Union, whether it was COMESA, whether it was Commonwealth, whether it was SADC, our concerns were basically the same. I think that they need to introduce the aspect of transparency in the elections moving forward. And this is a challenge that the Zimbabweans themselves have to do, both the parliamentarians and the Zimbabwean people, to insist on preparing, working on these issues and factors way before an election. If they use the same set of regulations, the laws that exist, or the systems of elections that currently obtain, they'll be getting similar results every election cycle. I think they need to sit down as Zimbabweans and redo their laws that are electoral laws that are going to, give representation to all Zimbabweans.
Dr. Neves Mumba is a former Zambian vice president and leader of the Southern African Development Community, or SADC, Pole Observer Mission. He spoke with me from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare. Meanwhile, the Opposition Citizen for Coalition Change, or CCC, has rejected the outcome of the elections. It claims to have evidence of rigging and plans to show it to Zimbabweans and the international community to prove the elections were rigged. For more reaction about the just-ended elections, I reached Promise Nkwananzi. He is the spokesperson for the Zimbabwean Main Opposition Party, CCC. Promise Nkwananzi is the spokesperson for the Zimbabwean Main Opposition Party, CCC. He spoke with me from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
The declaration by the Zimbabwe Election Commission is a nullity. President Nelson Chamisa is the actual victor in this election. All these announcements are false, they are fake, and they should be disregarded.
Why are you saying so?
The information and the evidence that this information is not correct. And as we speak, we know that they've tried to recall and round up all our polling agents to try and coerce them to sign revised V11s to align with the false results within the next 24 hours. So we know that the result that is about to be announced, that was announced yesterday, is not the accurate result that the people of Zimbabwe produced on the 23rd and the 24th of August, respectively.
So what is the CCC going to do with the evidence that you say you have?
At the appropriate time, we are going to to announce and showcase that evidence to the world. But this afternoon, our president, Advocate Nelson Chamisa, whom we believe is the winner of this election, is going to address the media and give a way forward.
What has been the response of your support since the Electoral Commission announced that President Emmerson Mnangagwa has won election at least 50% of the total vote?
because they are the ones that voted and they are the ones who know who they voted for. But President Chamisa has asked all our supporters to remain calm, to remain peaceful, and to wait for the direction that we are going to take in the next couple of hours when the president addresses the media.
So what's next?
President Chamisa is going to give his perspective on the elections and the next steps that we are going to take. But that's not all. There are other things that are happening that are not for the media to try and, you know, stop the theft that is underway as we speak by ZEC and ZANU-PF and the FAS shadowy group.
Promise Nkwananzi is the spokesperson for the Zimbabwean main opposition party, CCC. He spoke with me from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare. The 13th Commonwealth Women's Affairs Ministers meeting has ended in the Bahamas capital, Nassau. Opened by the Secretary General, Patricia Scotland, the three-day summit worked to expedite efforts to attain gender equality and to empower women and girls in climate action. The Women's Affairs Ministers also pledged to intensify efforts to address inequality in priority areas. They include women's economic empowerment, protections from gender-based violence, strengthening the role of women in climate finance, increased support for women with disabilities, and improved representation of women in decision-making. Analysts say recent disasters such as Cyclone Freddy in southeastern Africa have shown that women bear a disproportionate brunt of the impact due to gender inequalities. I reached Patricia Scotland via Skype to talk about the just concluded summit. Here is the conclusion of the conversation.
So, Madam Secretary General, what support will this need from men as well as governments to actualize this plan in order to help women? Basically they help men, you know, as you said.
Absolutely. Well, we are launching for the Women in My Life campaign because we need our men. You know, every single one of us has a mother, and without a mother, we would none of us be here. But we need our men because our men need to champion our women. Whilst we have this imbalance, we need that passion and absolute courage to say to our boys, this is not the future we want for them. And we need good men to stand shoulder to shoulder with us to make sure that this change happens for their mothers, for their daughters, for their cousins, for their friends, for their colleagues. And this has to be a joint endeavor. And so we are calling on all men to join our women and join our For the Women in My Life campaign. And I know, Peter, that you will be right there at the front, being one of the champions for the women in my life.
Wonderful. Madam Secretary General, before you go, talk to me about how the upcoming Commonwealth Ministers meeting will drive forward this agenda that you talked about, including in the COP28 context.
Well, we are taking the results of the Commonwealth Women Ministers meeting to the UN General Assembly. We're going to have a foreign ministers meeting in the margins of that meeting, but we're also going to have an environmental ministers meeting, the first environmental ministers meeting of the Commonwealth in the margins of the UN General Assembly on the 21st of September. That's the day after Antonio Guterres is going to have his meeting on climate on the 20th. But we're also taking this whole agenda to Africa because we are going to attend the Kenyan meeting of on climate in Nairobi. And so this message of change, this message of contribution from men and our women is going to be a real commitment. And all the ministers who met in Bahamas have committed to join together to deliver on climate action. And we are looking for loss and damage. You know that our Commonwealth Climate Finance Access Hub, which was created when I came into office in 2016, and we have had just a small amount of money, that's about $6 million, US dollars, we've already delivered $310 million into the hands of our member states, and we have another $500 million dollars in the pipeline. And all of that work, we want to be gender sensitive so that we will make sure we're mainstreaming the issues for men and women so we leave no one behind. But just imagine where would be if we were able to get the money to give a climate finance advisor to every country in our Commonwealth who needed one and wanted one. We could exponentially improve the amount of money that we make available to our countries to do that which they need to do, they want to do themselves, but don't have the finances to do. Think about the difference we would make. And we are taking that banner to the UN General Assembly, but we're also going to take it on to the COP in December. And we are determined that this COP is going to be the implementation COP. So we're not just be talking about words anymore. We'll be having action, and we will be wanting to see how we can deliver the 100 billion that was promised as long ago as 2009 and still has not been delivered. We want that money for our member states.
Patricia Scotland is the Secretary General of the Commonwealth. She spoke with me from the Bahamas capital, Nassau. In Uganda, a public lecture about Idi Amin is scheduled to begin on September 1st in the capital, Kampala. Organizers say the aim is to educate citizens about the life and legacy of the former military ruler, as well as to promote reconciliation. This after some Ugandans expressed concern about the lecture, saying it will be disturbing for victims of gross human rights violations during Amin's rule. CAF's Fungaru Hassan, the spokesperson for the group organizing the event, says it will seek to be fair to Amin's legacy. That includes what he says was the former leader's commitment to the independence of several countries in southern Africa. He tells me that consultations with all stakeholders are ongoing to ensure a successful public lecture.
Let me say this year, 2023, marked like 20 years since His Excellency Al-Hajj Field Marshal Idi Amin Dada died in Saudi Arabia. There are young people born after the fall of the government of Idi Amin Dada. They still have a feel of the presidency, the legacy of Field Marshal Idi Amin Dada. Both negatively and positively, they remember, they are reminded about Amin. On the negative side of things, there are people who are victimized for being associated with the Field Marshal Idi Amin Dada, either socially or politically by his regime, in the sense that their parents must have served in his government. But today, because of the negative branding of the image, the name, the person, and the government of President Idi Amin Dada, these people are suffering as if they had committed a crime.
Yeah, I'm talking about the branding, or what you call the negative stereotype of the legacy of Idi Amin. Victims of his administration are calling on the government not to even allow this, because it will remind them of the many allegations of torture that they went through. And this public lecture really will bring back bad memories. Are you not considerate about their concerns?
Yeah, Uganda has systems of conflict resolution within the community. Apart from what you know as court, there is what is known as the traditional way of settling disputes among people. It involves truth-telling. It involves reconciliation, forgiveness and reconciliation. And there are communities here in Uganda, particularly in northern Uganda. Generally, if you take West Nile on one side, Acholi Lango on the other side, families, individuals have crisscrossed borders to talk to each other in a way of truth-telling, in a way of seeking forgiveness, in a way of seeking for reconciliation. So this lecture is good for both sides.
Do you see why people think this is highly controversial? Did you reach out to people who have major concerns about Idi Amin and his legacy before going ahead with this lecture?
The Ministry of National Guidance and ICT has a minister called Honorable Dr. Chris Bariomo. We consulted the Honorable Minister about our intentions, and we even invited Honorable Minister Dr. Chris Bariomo to come and preside over the memorial lecture in the capacity of the chief guest on that occasion, so that in being there, he serves the interest and the role of the government of the Republic of Uganda, and he provides the necessary national guidance. We have also reached out to key stakeholders across the country. We reached Uganda Muslim Spring Council and talked, and we reached to other prominent people, scholars, like, for example, in Makerere University, Lemoni University, and in other places. The consultative process is still going on. So for us, this is a way of healing. This is a way of bringing peace into the hearts of Ugandans.
CAP's Fungaru Hassan is the spokesperson for the group
organizing the Idi Amin lecture. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Benin, an aspiring presidential candidate says building an economy based on production and processing is a key component to creating jobs for the country's youth. Daniel Eda, a former international civil servant of the Organization of La Francophonie and an expert on youth development, says a review of government policies, a competent and independent judiciary, as well as a robust fight against public corruption will significantly help attract both local and international investors to the West African nation. His remarks come as public sector workers and civil society groups demand better working conditions. Opposition groups also say the government is not doing enough to improve the economy, but supporters of the administration dismissed the accusation. They cite the positive economic outlook by the African Development Bank as proof that the government is working to improve lives. Daniel Elder tells me that a regional effort to produce enough energy to meet production needs for job creation will help reduce high youth unemployment.
Building the economy of production and processing is the way to give Benin people, you know, rest from the current poverty that is rampant, although the government might say they are trying their best. You know, no economy based on import and export can generate jobs for young people. And the main challenge that we have, not only in Benin, but in most of the African countries, is the high unemployment rate. So building the economy of production and processing will start with identifying the potential of each municipality in Benin, using that as the starting point. But of course, you can't build an economy of production and processing in an environment where there is no energy.
We talked about investment. A lot of African countries are trying to attract both local and foreign investors because that forms part of creating jobs for the youth. So what do you think can be done specifically in Benin that could attract investors?
I think we need to improve the judiciary system. It's important for any investor to be assured that wherever he or she is putting his money, he's protected by the state of law. And the other thing that we need to deal with, I'm not ashamed of it, but because it's our challenge and we'll address it properly, we need to deal with the corruption. You know, corruption is rampant. The late President General Machel Kiriku tried his best, but before him, President Soglo also tried, and after President Kiriku, President Yayi Boni also tried, and the current president is doing what he can, but it's a challenge for us to address the corruption, because wherever there is corruption, you know, no investor will feel safe. So besides the energy that we need to avail in quantity and in quality, besides the security that we need to increase for people to feel safe, besides the judiciary that we need to, you know, improve on, it's paramount to fight without fear, no favor, corruption.
Talking about building human capital, specifically, what do you think can be done in order to develop the human capital for the economy of production and processing for the country Benin?
Yeah, so far our education system has been run in nepotism. We're following what is happening in France mainly. So we need to get out of that and look into our own realities and ask ourselves what our needs. So that's the reason why I'm coming with the vision of an economically prosperous and socially stable Benin. And for that vision to be implemented successfully, we need a type of human capital adapted to it. So we'll adjust our education system to the vision of an economically prosperous and socially stable Benin. Meaning what? There are a lot of people with PhDs in Benin, with masters, with bachelors, who are not employed. Why? Because their skills are not adapted to the need. So it's important for us to question what type of human resource do we need to achieve the economically prosperous and socially stable Benin. Once we answer that, our education system, our training system, our training programs will be adjusted to the achievement of that vision. So there is no one, you know, coming, no country, who a friend of another country just to give without anything in return. So time has come for us to know what we are giving in the relationship with France and what France is giving to us. If we create that new basis of clarity, I think the friendship between France and Benin, as well as with the other African countries, has very, you know, a brighter future. But if we don't do that, what you've been saying of loss of influence will keep on going, and I don't think it will be benefit for anyone.
Daniel Eder is an aspiring presidential candidate in Benin. He spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe.
Hi, I'm VOA's Kim Lewis. Coming up on Issues in the News this weekend, former U.S. President Donald Trump was booked at a Georgia jail on 41 charges, and Republican presidential hopefuls sparred in the first debate leading up to the 2024 national election. Join us this weekend for Issues in the News.
In Zambia, a leading opposition figure says it is wrong for any government to use state institutions, including the police and the judiciary, to settle political scores against opponents. Chishimba Kambwili, a former minister and aspiring presidential candidate from the main opposition party Patriotic Front, says intimidation and harassment of opponents undermine democracy. This after Kambwili condemned what he says appears to be the frequent arrest and questioning of Fred Membe, the leader of the opposition Socialist Party. Membe was detained for questioning by the police over allegations of disturbances during a recent by-election. He denies the charges. Chishemba Kambwili tells me that the recent arrest of opposition leaders appeared to be a plan to divert attention from the prevailing economic conditions, including high food prices.
Opposition political parties are extremely disappointed with the behavior or turn of events of our friends in government under the UPND. It has become so bad that now most of the people are scared of talking. You know that in this country, civil society is very strong. But what he did, he got almost all the strong civil society and gave them jobs in government. And the few civil society that have remained are scared of talking, because whatever you say, the government will use the cyber security law to find something incriminating and arrest you, put you in detention without being taken to court for up to 10, 20 days, and then dilly-dallying taking you to court. Some people that have been arrested have never appeared in court, but they were detained up to about 15, 20 days without trial. So it is extremely bad that we have lost the civil and political space in Zambia.
Are you saying some of the allegations of repression and the clampdown on free speech that were leveled against the previous administration is happening now? Is that what you are saying?
It is more than it was happening in the previous regime. Look, for instance, Fred Membe merely said that one of the senior police officers refused to take advice from the Solicitor General to replace one of the officers who was fired on the flimsy ground, and that officer went into depression and died. Can you imagine that he was arrested, that he's defaming the officer, detained for 2 days, and gave him the charge of libel?
You can't make a thing up if you don't have of it. Otherwise, anybody can make any wild allegation, tarnish the image of the Zambian police, and get away with it. People be held accountable in spite of the fact that they're free. It comes with responsibility to come. Don't think...
Peter, what is happening today is unprecedented. President Akainde Ichilema himself, while he was in opposition, he made a lot of allegations against people. And I cannot say that Fred Membe does not have the evidence. He does have the evidence. He has challenged them that he has the evidence and he has the proof that this happened. So are you going to be arresting people for saying things when they have proof? What you need to do is to investigate whether indeed such an incident happened before you rush into arresting somebody and charge them with life.
Some people suggest that it is fair for Dr. Membe, invited by them, to provide the tests he had in order to clear any misconception, and if found not to have framed anybody, he goes scot-free. So people questioning the police and by extension the government of clamping down neither here nor there, and a tantamount plans by the opposition to make the government unpopular or defame the government. Your thoughts?
No, that is not true, my brother. That is not true. Let not government try to protect themselves using underhand method. You see, I believe that every responsible leader like Mr. Membe, myself and others, will not make wild allegations with without proof. Indeed, that man died. And the family are saying he died out of depression. So where did Dr. Membe go wrong? Where did he go wrong? There has been more arrests of opposition leaders more than ever before during this regime. For instance, me, I was advising the nation against voting on regional lines and voting on tribal lines to avoid dividing the nation. Instead of giving me a pat on the back, they arrest me that I'm encouraging tribalism. When you listen to my discourse, you find that I was actually discouraging tribalism and voting on tribal lines. Even saying these people who are voting on tribal lines, please do not hate them. Embrace them and just teach them that what they are doing is wrong. I'm arrested for encouraging tribalism. It doesn't work out.
Chishimba Kambwili is a leading opposition figure in the Patriotic Front, PF. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. Herbert Mensah, a prominent international businessman and sports administrator, is the new president of Rugby Africa for the next 4 years. He says boosting the growth of the game on the continent is his priority. He also seeks to ensure officials treat the sport as a business to generate revenues and development opportunities for member associations. I reached Herbert Mensah and began by asking him about his vision and plans for Rugby Africa.
Well, I think the vision for me is really quite clear. I have a history within sports administration, the last 20 years of recognizing one fundamental thing, and that is that sport is big business. The fundamentals are understanding that sport is big business, and therefore we have to change the dynamic of relationship with our global body, our relationship with others, and look at means of raising that whilst trying to make sure that it becomes the alternative sport to soccer across the continent of Africa.
You're talking about sports being a business. That means you have to change mindset, or you have to help people to realize and come around to your vision. How do you plan on doing that?
Well, you're absolutely correct. That is the word that I have used before I came to office and since. That is a change of mindset. That is a major issue here because we have to look at it two ways. I'm calling for a change of mindset internally first. I'm not one of those who says the world owes us. Nobody owes anybody in this dispensation. So we need to change internally the mindset. It means within Rugby Africa, there's a big shakeup. Are the right people in the right place? Do we need different people in? We need to get people who really appreciate that bottom line. We need to go out there and look for money. We need to look and understand that the dynamics of doing business in Africa is different from the rest of the world. You have to be completely different in your mindset. So we're looking for internal changes to recognize that. Once you have the right people in place, which is what we're trying to do now, with World Rugby, with the RFU, with FFR, when I say RFU, that's the English Rugby Football Union, which we're about to start, FFR, which is the French Rugby Federation, with the AU itself, African Union, to put rugby on the curriculum for schools in some format or other, and the others in terms of their funding programs directly through their existing sponsors or through the development agencies who are actually spending money in Africa for training and such like. We need to be in a position where we understand that funding now have to come from alternative sources.
Now, Herbert, how do you intend engaging respecting governments in Africa to actualize this dream? Because, as you know, in Africa, governments play key roles in how administrations are run, or even, you know, any business or entity, sports-wise, are run in their countries across Africa.
You're absolutely correct, and I think this is something that I've come in and I've had to bring in my past experience from running Kumasi Asante Cotton Corps to the world of rugby to understand that we need, if you're not politically linked, then you are compromised. And I think that the leadership of rugby generally across Africa is not politically linked, and then the challenges are there. It is not like, as I said, if it is Patrice Motsepe, who are wealthy in their own right, the owners of TP Mazembe and all the other massive clubs across Africa, they are either massive business entities unto themselves, or they have the political wherewithal to move forward. I've been in office now for 4 to 5 months, and what I've done in this time period is engage presidents and ministers in sports so far in 7 countries, and I'm
on a mission to get through all of those who are ready to do business. We now have some. I sat recently with the Honorable Minister and Cabinet Secretary in Kenya, and I have so much respect for them. And I said, we need to move forward in a different way.
Hebron Mensah is a prominent international businessman and sports administrator and the new president of Rugby Africa. He spoke with me from the British capital, London. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Samson O'Malley. That will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from African Collection. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Samson O'Malley. Hello, Samson.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The quest for continental glory continued on Saturday as more clubs sealed their places in the next stage of the CAF Champions League preliminary round. After a 2-1 away loss to Namibia's African Stars, Zambia's Power Dynamos managed a hard-fought 1-0 victory to advance to the next round, with the aggregate score being 2-2. The Zambians' victory set them up with an interesting battle against Tanzanian powerhouse Simba SC in the next round. In another fixture on the southern part of the continent, Eswatini's Green Mamba welcomed UD Songo of Mozambique in the thrilling encounter that concluded with a 1-1 draw, with the Mozambicans marching into the next round on a 2-1 aggregate score following their 1-0 win last weekend. UD Songo will now face Angola's Petro Atletico in the next round. Last season's CAF Confederations Cup runners-up Young Africans thrashed Djiboutian club Ali Sabia 5-1 at home to make the aggregate score 7-1 in what was a one-sided affair at the Azam Complex in Chamazi, Tanzania. Moving up north, Tunisia's ES du Sahel finished the job at home against Algeria's CS Constantine with a narrow 1-0 win, which was enough to see them through following their 2-0 first-leg win in Constantine last week. Uganda's Vipers FC were determined to reverse a 2-0 defeat suffered at the hands of Jawaneng Galaxy in Botswana. The East Africans were, however, dealt a heavy blow just minutes before full time as Galaxy pulled on back to make the score 3-2 on aggregate to the dismay of the host. The first round of the preliminary stage concludes on Sunday to determine the final fixtures of the second round of the preliminary stage, where the fight for a place in the group stages intensifies. Staying with the Confederation of African Football, the continent's governing football body and the Saudi Arabian Football Federation have announced Saudi Arabia to be this year's host of the CAF Super Cup 2023, scheduled for the 15th of September. The CAF Super Cup Final 2023 will be contested by current CAF Champions League champions Al Ahly SC and Algeria's USMA, the champions of the CAF Confederations Cup. The match is scheduled to be played at the city of Taif at the iconic King Fahad Stadium. In basketball news, the prestigious 2023 FIBA Basketball World Cup is officially underway. 32 teams are in the fight to be crowned world champions, with the final taking place on the 10th of September in Manila's Mall of Asia Arena. The first group phase sees all participating nations divided into 8 groups of 4 teams. Angola, South Sudan, Egypt, and Cote d'Ivoire are representing Africa. In some of the games played on Saturday, South Sudan narrowly lost to Puerto Rico 101-96. Cape Verde lost 60-85 to Georgia. Spain beat Cote d'Ivoire 94-64. Sunday's game will see Egypt play Montenegro, while Philippines will play Angola. And that's all for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Samson. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. There is a general consensus amongst BRIC members that the 15th summit of BRIC group has been successful and sees it as a historical event. This is not a hyperbole. During 3 days of consultations, eight informal sessions, retreats, and bilateral discussions, the BRIC members were frank, clear-thinking, and not hesitant to point out their view of the current international situation. They are in common agreement, one, that they do not want to be a small, inclusive group of member states who have the same views on many issues. For them, the BRIC group is a group of nations who have a shared history of colonialism and imperialism and underdevelopment. It is for this group, for this reason, that the group seeks to be inclusive and to appreciate diverse opinion in harmony. But they do have a common purpose, and they also wish to economize or end underdevelopment and to proceed on a developed stage. They are not worried if the expanded group members do not agree on many international issues. They see this as, in fact, a plus. The members also agreed that they do not agree that there is a system of hierarchical values before which all other states must kowtow. They believe that a world order is not shaped by a small group, but should be the work of the global community. That is why they stress again and again that they believe in multilateralism based on the letter and spirit of the United Nations Charter, which pledged to save mankind from the scourge of war and the maintenance of international peace and security. They express disapproval of the dominance of multilateral organizations of the Western powers, and they want more democratization of these institutions, including the financial institutions. The group members want to stress that they are not in confrontation with the West, and they do not seek to replace existing organizations of like-mindedness. In fact, they would wish for cooperation, and they stressed that in particular the democratization of the Bretton Woods institution. They also made clear that they do not agree that member states of BRICS should choose whom they want to have as their partner and not be told those which should not be their members or their partners. The decision to expand BRICS is a joint one. It is reached by consensus, and it was not haphazard and not sudden. According to the host president, Cyril Ramaphosa, the consultation of the expansion has been going on for a very, very, very long time. And let me add that at the sideline of this summit, the president of China, Xi Jinping, met with a large number of heads of state of African countries in the China-Africa consultation. He expressed China's commitment to work closely with African countries, particularly, he pledged, the plan to industrialize Africa, a long, long expected objective of the African states. And he pledged two programs, one for $10 billion, another for $4 million, that should help this goal and purpose. Let us note that just after the close of the summit, already the airwaves were being filled with those who are not well informed for trying to minimize the importance of the summit. I dare say any careful study of the closing session of the summit will prove that the efforts will be futile. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Any little thing that we do, she be within me. Happy birthday, this be your cake. The party tonight before my place. Oh. Invite all your friends, Rose and Kato. Disaster like me, they work for NATO. Oh, my darling, Melissa. Post
make a woman take me picture. If I no marry you in future, like a grace, I just wanna be a mister. Oh my darling, Melissa. Oh bro, Melissa. It's my watch and it's my pizza. Oh bro, Melissa. Oh my darling. Oh bro, Melissa. It's my watch and it's my pizza. Because for the universities, your body no be paper, but I love your properties. Go tell your father, Mr. Socrates, say I make ready to make you my missus. Oh my darling, hey, Melissa, boss make a who could take me picture. If I no marry you in future, like a grace, I just wanna be a mister. Oh my darling, hey, Melissa, oh bro, hey, Melissa, it's my watch and it's my pizza. Oh bro, hey, Melissa. I get many dreams and plans specially for you, so don't put me for waiting you. Oh, any little thing that we do should be between me and you. Happy birthday, this be your cake, oh. The party tonight before my place, oh. Invite all your friends, Rose and Kato. Disaster like me, they work for NATO. Oh my darling, hey, Melissa. Boss maker who could take me picture. If I no marry you in future, like a grace, I just wanna be a mister. Oh my darling, hey, Melissa. Oh bro, hey, Melissa. It's my watch and it's my pizza. Oh bro, hey, Melissa. Oh bro, hey, Melissa. It's my watch and it's my pizza. Oh bro, hey, Melissa. Oh my darling.
Arriba, bailar conmigo. Come on, let's do it together. Cantaré, cantaré mi vida es tu vida. Si se puede, si
yeah,
se puede.
Yeah, yeah,
come on, let's
yeah,
do it look, together.
We got the forgotten, like lost knowledge. More mileage, we bled for blood diamonds. Yeah, we bled often, sacrifice an offering. Life can get cold like we live in Boston. But if we come together, keep it running, then maybe one day we can make some progress, hey. Maybe one day we make some progress. So before we roll the dice, better be cautious, hey. Better be cautious. Now look at us, we flossing. I don't wanna see my brother in the coffin. We need less hate, more loving.
Cantaré,
yeah, yeah,
cantaré,
yeah, yeah.
Mi vida es tu vida. Si se puede, si se puede. Come on, let's do it together. Cantaré, cantaré, mi vida es tu vida. Si se puede, si se puede. Tiramos.
Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. I hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the child of an elephant will not be a dwarf. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington.